Sometimes history sets people on a collision course. Even if they had wanted to avoid each other, they just couldn't have. The two men we're going to talk about this hour shared important similarities. Each was smart, ambitious, aggressive, and sometimes very defensive. But the list doesn't go on much beyond that, because Lyndon Baines Johnson and Robert F. Kennedy were about as different as men could be. Lyndon Johnson was from the hill country of Texas, came to adulthood as the Great Depression ravaged Texas. And he befriended Sam Rayburn, the powerful Texas congressman, gained first appointed, then elected office, heading to the Congress in 1937. After missing in his first bid for the Senate, he squeaked in 1948 and rose quickly from whip to floor leader to majority leader at just 46 years old. Lyndon Johnson represented an older kind of politics, before TV, before makeup, a politics of alliances and patronage and clout. The ground was shifting under LBJ's feet, though. As America moved from being a country where party operatives picked presidential candidates to one where primary voters do. When Lyndon Johnson became a congressman in 1937, Robert Kennedy was still a boy, living with his father, the American ambassador to Britain. When he graduated from the University of Virginia Law School in 1951, he seemed to be even further in age from the U.S. Senator from Texas. His adulthood had not been shaped in the same way by depression and war, and as a son of vast wealth, an Easterner, a Catholic, his America was a quite different place from Lyndon Johnson's. He helped make his brother a U.S. Senator in 1952, was a counsel to Senator McCarthy, and chief counsel to the hearings into organized crime control of labor unions. The two men's lives would become unavoidably and forever intertwined by 1960. John Kennedy wanted to be the Democratic nominee for president. So did Lyndon Johnson. Robert Kennedy was his brother's campaign manager and confidant. Lyndon Johnson, a member of his party's royalty, who had to settle for second place. You may know the rest. Still in his 30s, Robert Kennedy became Attorney General, and Vice President Lyndon Johnson felt he was shoved aside. But in 1963, LBJ became president, and before long, Robert Kennedy was gone as Attorney General. The country entered a terrible period of war abroad and conflict at home. Robert Kennedy headed to the Senate and was running for Johnson's job when his own life ended in 1968. Two men, two fascinating lives, and one bitter rivalry. Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy this hour on the program. Jeff Schessel is with me here in Studio 3A, author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. He's also the creator of the nationally syndicated political comic strip, Thatch. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks.
Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Well, you were 4 years old when Lyndon Johnson died?
That's about right.
And not born yet when Robert Kennedy died. What's the attraction for this particular story?
Well, what drew me into this story was a book that was released about 10 years ago, a collection of interviews with Robert Kennedy, in which he spoke of Lyndon Johnson with such naked hostility that I was taken aback as somebody who didn't yet know much about this period. I had no idea that the two were antagonists. Kennedy spoke of Johnson as mean, bitter, vicious, an animal in many ways. And it really occurred to me then that there was a story there, and I spent really the last 6 or 7 years uncovering exactly what that story was. But as far as what drew me as a younger person to that period of history, I think it's the vividness of these two characters. It's the intensity of the clash between the two of them and the passions, not only that they felt about the issues and about one another, but that they inspired in other people. All things that seem to be lacking very much in the politics of today or in the politics of my lifetime, as I remember them. The 80s were pretty tranquil years.
Yeah, in comparison with the 60s, yeah, I'd have to go along with you on that. These particular men, though, you would think on many grounds they would have been made allies by circumstance. Politics is full of people who really don't have much time for each other, really. But every time you see them together, they're smiling and shaking hands. This was different, though.
No, there was something very different about this. And these two men smiled and shook hands before the cameras just like any other politicians. And when they had to come together for the sake of public appearances, as they did in 1964, when they waged a campaign together in New York, Robert Kennedy for the Senate, as you mentioned, and Johnson, of course, for the presidency, they did what they had to do. But privately, they could barely speak to one another. And the battles between the two of them over the course of the 1960s were so frequent and so intense that they became widely known to the press and the public, and there was a great public fascination with the feud between these two characters. There was absolutely no hiding the animosity, and there was no disguising the stakes of what was at issue between the two of them.
Lyndon Johnson must have thought that he was being pretty hard done by, though, by Kennedy, because he had really, in many ways, paid his dues and double paid them. And he rammed through a legislative program in the early years of his presidency that was not totally his. He can claim some great accomplishments on civil rights that perhaps Kennedy didn't have the personal clout to make happen, with a Senate still largely dominated by old-line Democrats from the South. And yet he knew he was thought little of by the Kennedys and by people like the Kennedys, Ivy League, Eastern, wealthy. This guy had a lot of phantoms he was fighting.
He certainly did, and he was fairly obsessed by his imagined rejection and very real rejection in many senses by this Eastern elite, by the Harvards and the Bostons, as he called them, generic terms he used to describe just about anybody from the North, anybody with an Ivy League or comparable education. He always imagined that this pack of critics was lying in wait for him to make the slightest misstep, and that even when he achieved a great success, it was somehow never enough for them. And they were embodied for Johnson by Robert Kennedy,
who was a pretty prickly character himself, make no mistake.
He was a very difficult character, and Johnson was not the only one in Washington who had a personality conflict, who had a, as Johnson put it, a chemical imbalance in his relationship with Kennedy. Kennedy despised politicians, despite what one might assume by his life in politics and by his life as a very effective electoral politician, getting his brother elected in 1952, waging a very hard-fought campaign on his own in 1964 for the Senate in New York. Robert Kennedy despised the political class, people who loved politics and loved the process of politics, people like Lyndon Johnson, back-slapping politicians full of blarney. He was never like that, Robert Kennedy. He believed that politics was a difficult and ugly means of getting things done, and that's how he perceived it from the very beginning. And he was remarkably insensitive in his treatment of other politicians, and was prone to yelling at old-line politicians 30 or 40 years his seniors in the Kennedy headquarters in 1952 in Massachusetts.
But it was that kind of politician which, for all the problems they had, still made things happen in the country. And that kind of contempt, where did that come from? A sort of post-war understanding that you could, by being a technocrat and by being smart and by getting rid of all that old baggage of politics, put government on some new kind of footing so that you didn't need the Lyndon Johnsons of the world?
Well, I do think that Robert Kennedy felt that in 1960, the election of John Kennedy and his great defeat of Lyndon Johnson for the nomination in 1960 indicated that we had indeed approached a new frontier, and we no longer needed politicians like Lyndon Johnson. And it was a great shock to Kennedy's system and to the system of all the new frontiersmen, to see a man, an old school politician like Johnson, suddenly assume the presidency and have to essentially pledge their allegiance to him and his brand of politics and his brand of government. And it was something that they were very loath to do. I wouldn't, though, characterize Kennedy as a technocrat. I think that he and his brother both saw themselves, and I think others certainly saw them as men of great vision, as progressives in a way. Not progressives in the 1920s sense of bringing science into government and ridding the process of politics, but looking forward to a different kind of era with a different kind of very vivid and active activist leadership. So he did feel that they had passed the point where politicians like Lyndon Johnson would be effective. And he was wrong about that, as Johnson's remarkable successes in 1964 and 65 in particular show.
If you're just joining us, Jeff Schessel is with me in Washington. He's the author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. He also draws a comic strip called Thatch. And we're talking about the 60s, and by extension, of course, the 50s that set the stage for them, and the relationship between these two national politicians who, incidentally, couldn't stand each other. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. One thing that's come out in recent years is the very warm and compassionate relationship between LBJ and Jackie Kennedy, which was something, of course, separate and much apart from that with Robert Kennedy, but did you look at that at all?
I did look at it a little bit, and there is a bit on that in Mutual Contempt. Johnson treated Jackie Kennedy, even prior to the assassination of John Kennedy, but especially afterwards, with great dignity. And she always felt that way and was always thankful toward Johnson for his treatment of her, particularly in the days after the assassination. Robert Kennedy, on the other hand, felt that Johnson had grossly mistreated Jackie Kennedy in those days, whether Jackie admitted it or not. Definitely an unfair judgment. I think Jacqueline Kennedy was well equipped to speak for herself on that matter. But the letters back and forth between Johnson and Jacqueline Kennedy show a real and genuine warmth.
And it's interesting then how that could be so misread, because apparently in the days before John Kennedy's death, the vice president did not associate Jacqueline Kennedy with the Bostons and Harvards, even though she was something of a blue blood, Newport Society, French finishing schools and all of that.
And Johnson would have associated Jack Kennedy with that group, but he never ever showed a trace of animosity toward John Kennedy. He showed envy toward John Kennedy. He felt somewhat outclassed by him, not only culturally, but as a politician after 1959 and 1960. But he never spoke a word against John Kennedy and wouldn't tolerate a word spoken against John Kennedy in his presence. And this seems to be very genuinely felt. John Kennedy treated Johnson with great respect. Great might be putting it a little bit strongly, but he certainly treated Johnson with respect when Johnson was vice president and tried to ensure that the White House staff did the same. John Kennedy was not very successful in that, and Robert Kennedy was one of the greater offenders.
Well, it's interesting that he could be trifled with in that way. After all, this was a guy who was the protege of Sam Rayburn, a formidable politician. Nobody becomes Senate Majority Leader at 46 unless they've got something on the ball. And the idea that he could be treated as some hick was very interesting, because he still knew where all the bodies were buried on Capitol Hill. He was a guy who could pick up a phone and talk to anybody. These had some downsides, too, these personality traits. But they weren't dealing with a bumpkin here.
No, they weren't, in fact. And one of the reasons that he was treated with this sort of cruel indifference at best during the Kennedy years is because he had been so strong and because he had been so effective in the 1950s. The Senate itself was very relieved to be out from under the thumb of LBJ. And those who had worked in John Kennedy's Senate office and had sometimes suffered under the command of Lyndon Johnson were delighted to have the power inverted in this way and to have Johnson be so impotent in the new arrangement of power.
Whether you remember those times firsthand or were just watching them, you may be interested in reading about them as well. It's a very interesting story about two men who, in both their different ways, took long journeys from where they started to where they ended up politically, emotionally, and as people on the public stage. 800-989-8255. Beaverton, Oregon is our first stop this hour. Hi, Rich.
I'm disappointed that you don't have of Robert Carroll on the program. I think he is probably the has proved with his two prior books, and he's got a third one coming out now, the preeminent authority on Lyndon Johnson and his relationship with Bobby Kennedy. But that's neither here nor there.
You're right, Rich. It is neither here nor there, if you have a question.
I have two questions. Number one, does your author have information that Lyndon Johnson cried in 1960 and begged to be left off the ticket when Robert Kennedy went to him and told him that they hadn't expected him to accept the offer and that he was just going to have to leave the ticket, have to get somebody else? And number two, does your author know about the call from J. Edgar Hoover to Jack Kennedy? This was reported by Evelyn Lincoln, his secretary, that more or less threatened John Kennedy with disclosures that would have been embarrassing if he refused to keep Johnson on the ticket. And I'll listen to your sources' responses on the air. Thanks, Ray.
Rich in Beaverton, Oregon.
Well, Rich, let me begin with your point about Johnson's tears at the 1960 convention. You've got some of the basics of the story down, a story that I describe in all its Byzantine detail in the book. But the essence of what you're getting at is after the Kennedys had made a very tentative offer of the president of the vice presidency to LBJ, and he grabbed it. There ensued a panic in the Kennedy camp about the consequences of this decision. And over the course of several hours of debate, they decided that Robert Kennedy should go down to the Johnson suite and try to talk him off the ticket. RFK made three trips down to the Johnson suite, and he was finally granted an audience with LBJ on the third trip to the suite and sat with Johnson alone on a couch. And as Robert Kennedy described the conversation, he had offered Johnson the chairmanship of the DNC in exchange for withdrawing himself from the ticket under the premise that there was going to be great opposition from liberals and labor to Johnson's presence on the ticket, which in fairness was a real fear of the Kennedys at the time. Tears welled up in Johnson's eyes, according to Robert Kennedy, and he said, if the president, already referring to JFK as the president, if the president will make a fight for it, I'd be honored to be his vice president. And that was it. There was no talking Johnson off the ticket. So I think that is what you're referring to there. As far as any calls from Hoover to JFK at the convention, I've not seen any record of that. Certainly Hoover and Lyndon Johnson were great friends, but there's been no indication in any of the research that I've done that Hoover got at all involved in the selection of the vice president in 1960. And a last point about Robert Caro, I should point out that in all fairness to Caro's record as a scholar, he has not yet written about the relationship between Johnson and Robert Kennedy. He has not nearly reached that point in his chronology.
When you talk about Johnson's record, I find it curious that there would be that opposition, because this was not a guy, this was a New Dealer. This was someone who had made sure some civil rights legislation was shoved down the throat of the then-sitting Republican president in the late 50s. Why was there that suspicion? Was it strictly regional?
Well, there were two kinds of suspicion. There was suspicion among the liberals toward Johnson's record on civil rights, which, despite his passing the 1957 and the 1960 civil rights bills, was not all that stellar. He had not signed the Southern Manifesto along with other Southerners during the 1950s. But he did not have an outstanding record on civil rights, and he was in the process of trying to rehabilitate himself on that count, because I don't believe in any sense Johnson was a segregationist. I think the rhetoric of 1963 and 64 was deeply felt on Johnson's part, and those who attribute the civil rights bill to some sort of political cynicism on Johnson's part, I think, are very wrong about that. But there was suspicion in the liberal camp in 1960, and there was suspicion in the labor camp as well, because of Johnson's support in the 1950s, along with John Kennedy's support for labor reform in the wake of the Ricketts hearings that you mentioned earlier. John Kennedy and Johnson had both supported the Landrum-Griffin bill, which had reformed labor practices in a way that was not particularly favorable to the unions themselves.
We'll go next to the Kennedy hometown, Brookline, Massachusetts, birthplace of John Kennedy. Chris, welcome.
Thanks again for being on the show. My points, one thing I'd like to say is the flag still flies on Robert Kennedy's birthplace, which is not the same house as JFK's, but nearby in the same neighborhood. What I would like to say is, one, there was definitely competition between the two, as you're remarking, and I can think certainly in one aspect, you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover, another one would be that Robert F. Kennedy, being the Attorney General, through his brother, had full access to the CIA and was fascinated with the agency, spent a lot of time over there when he was Attorney General, which is not well known in the public. Two, I also might add that a lot of the contention during the early primary stages of 68, when Robert was not yet a candidate and LBJ still was that it was Eugene McCarthy that defeated the standing president in the New Hampshire primary, not Robert, even though Robert eventually took the nomination in the long run. And he didn't stick his neck out initially in the anti-war movement, initially fighting the president, until after LBJ had made his decision not to run. And I think that's one of the things that Americans don't understand in what happened at that time. But Robert certainly was controversial, and I think to this day there are still a lot of people in my town here that don't believe that Sirhan Sirhan killed him, and I'm not going to speculate as to who did, but there are people that state that Robert Owen and some other individuals involved with evangelical causes in California might have been involved.
Chris, with us from Brookline, Massachusetts. I don't know if we can solve the riddles of the Kennedy assassination this hour on the program, but is Chris's timeline right, that RFK was not out as an anti-war candidate before early March of 1968 when Johnson declined to run?
Well, it depends on what you call an anti-war figure. He had expressed reservation about the course of the war from the very beginning, even before Johnson's escalation of July 1965. He had spoken in May 1965 to express reservations about the course that America was taking and his hopes that we were about to take a very different path than the one he knew we were about to take. But you're right about 1960 in that it was McCarthy who didn't actually beat Johnson in New Hampshire in March of 1968, but came very close to beating Johnson and therefore created the impression that he had unseated the president. He had done very serious damage to LBJ in that primary, and Robert Kennedy didn't come in until afterward, prompting a McCarthy campaign hand to say that we felt that it was Christmas morning after the New Hampshire vote and that Bobby Kennedy had come downstairs and stolen all of our presents. There was a lot of bitterness between the McCarthy and the Kennedy camps. But what we have to keep in mind is that Robert Kennedy was in a very difficult position because of his relationship with LBJ, both with respect to the anti-war movement and with respect to the 1968 campaign. He understood that every time he spoke out against the war from 1965 onward, it was portrayed in the press as an attack on LBJ. The headlines read, "Kennedy attacks Johnson," not "Kennedy attacks Johnson's Vietnam policy." And it was always portrayed as a personal vendetta, and the actual issues that were at dispute between the two of them were often ignored, even in papers like the New York Times. And the same problem plagued him in 1960, and he believed that if he stepped out first and ran against Johnson, that it would be called a vendetta and it would not be seen as a campaign of issues.
Jeff Schessel is with me in Washington. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Chris in Brookline, Massachusetts, thanks for your call. Don's with us now from St. Louis. Hiya, Don.
Hi, Ray. You continually outdo yourself on your programs. I just bought Mr. Schessel's book the other day, and I've found it fascinating. The two questions that I had in sort of a what-if situation, one, what was there really a realistic possibility that LBJ was going to be dumped in 1964? And two, was there a realistic chance that Robert Kennedy would actually win the nomination in 1968? And thanks for the time.
Don, thanks for your call. Two good questions.
Well, I'll take your first question first. Regarding Johnson in 1964, he certainly believed that he was going to be dumped from the Kennedy ticket in 1964. He was terrified of this. He had a very bad year with the Kennedys.
This meaning prior to the assassination.
I should have pointed that out. He, throughout 1963, felt that he was in serious danger of being dumped from the ticket, and had begun to look for other work. He actually was considering taking a college presidency in Texas, and he mumbled to a lot of friends that he was going to retire because his past 3 years with the Kennedys had been so miserable. The loss of power had just crippled Johnson, and he had not really found a role as vice president president, he had found that the two areas that he had wanted to assume leadership in, civil rights and international relations, both had been usurped, in his view, by Robert Kennedy, whose domain was growing ever wider under his brother's presidency. There was never any real likelihood that Johnson was going to be dumped, although the Kennedys did consider the fact that if the Bobby Baker scandal, which I describe in the book, this was one of Johnson's proteges. He had been the Secretary of the Senate, and he had been considered by some to be little Lyndon Johnson. He was Johnson's right-hand man in the Senate, and he was embroiled in a serious financial scandal in 1963 and 1964. He eventually went to prison for some of these charges, and some thought that this scandal might bring Johnson down. And if it had really looked like that, the Kennedys probably would have dropped him in 64.
Let's keep the 1968 part of Don's question for after the break. My guest is Jeff Schessel, author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll talk with historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. about the LBJ-RFK feud, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. To contact us here at Talk of the Nation, you can send us email at totn@npr.org or regular mail, the address here, Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. At 33 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the W. Walton Jones Foundation for coverage of issues affecting ongoing threats of nuclear war and proliferation, and Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-the-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ray Suarez. Lee Nam-ok was raised as a daughter by the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il. After 5 years in self-exile, now in her 30s, she's decided to speak out in response to what she considers distorted coverage of her homeland by Western media. Ms. Lee joins us to share her unique insight into Korean society, the famine, economic crisis, and the man she still thinks of as her father on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. We're joined now by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Special Assistant to President John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy's biographer. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, sir.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about that resentment, that animosity between President Johnson and Robert Kennedy. Before the death of John Kennedy, was this sort of an open secret in the White House as someone who knew both men? Was it sort of a thing that everybody knew about and could talk about?
Well, it wasn't a major issue, but people knew about it. It went back, I suppose, to the Los Angeles Convention in 1960, where Robert Kennedy did not want Lyndon Johnson on the ticket and tried to persuade him to get off. And that there is a... But beyond that, I believe, as Jeff Schessel points out in his fine book, there's a sort of a chemical
antipathy between the two. John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson got along perfectly well, but Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson just automatically and chronically disliked each other.
Can you think of any times during the early 60s in particular when the country might have been the loser because these two men couldn't get together on some of the great issues of the day?
Well, I think they're substantially in agreement on the domestic issues. When after Johnson became president, their great area of disagreement was, of course, Vietnam. I think Jeff Shesol has written a very good book, but I think the title is somewhat misleading. Neither of the men had contempt for the other. They just liked each other. They had sort of grudging respect for each other. Contempt isn't quite the right word, but there was certainly mutual animosity. But they had each recognized that the other was a formidable fellow.
And a person of accomplishment? Or was there still some resentment in LBJ, for instance, of Robert Kennedy's privileged background, let's say?
Well, I think LBJ was... There was also a generational gap between them. I mean, LBJ was 16 or 17 years older than Robert Kennedy, and he regarded him as a young jerk who was coming along too fast. And, the Eastern is very odd in a way, because at least Lyndon Johnson went to college and so on. There's no reason, it's always been rather mysterious to me why he should have had this same feeling of inferiority. Harry Truman, who never went to college, who got along perfectly well with people like Dean Acheson and Averell Harriman, who were pure representatives of the Eastern establishment. He didn't have any sense of inferiority. But Johnson felt very keenly the difference between himself and the Harvards. He didn't have that kind of security, I guess, which Harry Truman had.
So even if he had not become president of the United States, this might have been an important part of his character, that feeling that he just wasn't... Up to their social standard.
Well, it wasn't so much that as that they had advantages that he hadn't had, but he'd had more advantages than Harry Truman had. But Harry Truman wasn't filled with that sort of envy and resentment.
At the end of both their lives, were either of the two men on a trajectory toward reconsidering that time and maybe forming a different opinion about the other?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so, because the Vietnam issue was still unresolved, and Robert Kennedy felt we ought to get out of that war, and Johnson still hoped that we might be able to win it, or at least get some kind of negotiated terms. They might have joined in domestic policy, because their views were very much along the same line, but by this time, the Vietnam War has followed up LBJ's Great Society.
And what should we, almost 25 years removed from the death of LBJ and almost 30 years removed from his departure from the White House, make overall of his time as president?
Well, I think LBJ is a very considerable figure, and he deserves particular credit for his strong stand he took on racial issues. But I think the sadness about President Johnson was he sacrificed his domestic policy, where his knowledge was great and his instincts were sure, on the altar of foreign policy, where his knowledge was meager and his instincts were simplistic.
Arthur Schlesinger, thanks for being with us today.
Good luck.
Arthur Schlesinger.
Say hello to Jeff Shesol.
Will do.
Okay.
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was a special assistant to President John Kennedy and a biographer of Robert Kennedy. He joined us by phone from his office in New York. My guest for the rest of the hour, Jeff Shesol, author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. He's also the creator of the nationally syndicated political comic strip Thatch. If you want to join us, our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. Denny's with us now from Columbus, Ohio. Hiya, Denny.
Hello, Ray. You kind of touched on what I was going to ask about. You were talking about civil rights earlier, and I think Johnson's handling of that question was a lot more courageous than the Kennedy's administration. And that coupled with his social legislation, I think maybe makes him the best president of my lifetime. I'm only 43. That is at least on the domestic side of the ledger. And I was wondering how your author would, if he'd care to speculate, I know it leads down a lot of blind alleys, but without Vietnam, if it doesn't happen or it's handled differently and we're able to extricate ourselves from that, how would Johnson be treated in history?
Well, Denny, I'll begin with the first part of your question about what Johnson brought to the civil rights issue. And I think you're right. He infused it with a moral urgency that it had lacked during the administration of John Kennedy, or certainly lacked until the events in Birmingham in 1963. The Kennedys prior to that point certainly wanted civil rights reform. They had relatively good relations with the civil rights leaders, but they were not going to expend an enormous amount of political capital trying to push Southern conservative Democrats to desegregate further than they already had been forced to.
Because they were figures of some suspicion to those senators anyway.
No, they certainly were, and they felt that it would jeopardize the rest of the legislative program that they were trying to push through the Senate and the House. And the civil rights bill that the Kennedys had offered up in 1963 was nowhere near as substantial as the one that Johnson reintroduced after the death of John Kennedy. And Johnson actually, this is one of the few occasions in which he actually voiced his displeasure with the course that the Kennedy administration was taking, privately, of course, not publicly. But he very strongly urged the administration to take a strong moral stand on the issue, to actually send President Kennedy down to the South with a black honor guard on stage behind him and confront Southerners with a moral issue. He said to Ted Sorensen in a telephone conversation that was recorded and that I reprint here in the book, he said, "You've got a little pop gun out there. I want to see the cannon." And the cannon is the President of the United States. He needs to get behind this. And it was really only after Birmingham that John Kennedy did so and made his very famous speech and used words that were almost taken verbatim from a speech that Johnson had given on the anniversary of Gettysburg. So yes, Johnson did bring a moral urgency to the legislative package that the Kennedys had designed to address the civil rights problem. As far as assessing Johnson without Vietnam, that's a very difficult thing to do. And even if we try to remove that completely from the picture, he certainly encountered plenty of problems at home with his poverty reforms and so forth, and the riots in the cities and so forth. So I don't think we want to take at all any credit away from him for his enormous domestic achievements. But it was a very difficult decade at home, not just because of the war.
It's a very hard thing to do intellectually because, I mean, if you're a historian, the way he handled the war shows you things about his character and his eyesight, his moral eyesight, his inward eyesight, that maybe you wouldn't have been able to see about him otherwise. But it's part of the package. You can't say, well, except for the fact that he blundered badly here, he was terrific, because part of what he showed us by blundering, not just Johnson, but any public figure who has this terrible one error, they show us something about themselves which we factor into the rest of the package in deciding something about them. I mean, that's my way of looking.
Well, it absolutely has to be taken into account, and Mr. Schlesinger has it exactly right in that Johnson's instincts were very sure at home domestically, but in terms of foreign policy, he had never been much interested in international relations as a senator, and that lack of experience and lack of confidence really showed during his presidency, and there's no way that one can be president and really disregard that side of things.
Denny in Columbus, Ohio, thanks a lot for your call. Tom's with us now from Burbank, California. Hiya, Tom.
Hi. I was involved in the Bobby Kennedy campaign. I had just gotten out of the Air Force and was unfortunately in Los Angeles that evening of the primary. I must tell you that when we had come out of Oregon and we had won California, in our opinion then, and in my opinion after all these years, we had won the nomination for the party, and we had won the White House. I mean, there was a lot of things we had to do, but it was clear all the way through. And I can remember in the McGovern campaign arguing with Eugene McCarthy people that we had stolen the election from Eugene, and us saying, no, we were waiting for Bobby. And they said, but how could you know you were waiting for Bobby? And I said, because we knew he was going to run.
Well, this piggybacks on Don's earlier question from St. Louis. Was Robert Kennedy, in your view, Jeff, on his way to, well, at least the Democratic nomination in Chicago?
That, too, is one of those what-if, or as historians say, counterfactual questions that I would hate to try to answer definitively. But I will say that we have to keep in mind that Hubert Humphrey had a 2-1 lead in delegates, that the primaries that Robert Kennedy was continuing to win by the time of his death counted less than they did after the rules changes that helped sweep McGovern into the nomination in 1972. And Kennedy was going to face a very steep battle towards the convention. I will add, however, that if Kennedy continued to win primaries in a spectacular fashion, and I do think that he would have, he was on his way to victory in Illinois, to victory in New York, and so forth, that he would have arrived at the convention with probably fewer delegates than Hubert Humphrey, who had been collecting them quietly from party leaders. But Humphrey would have been so discredited by that point by Kennedy's outstanding appearance and by Humphrey's unwillingness to engage Kennedy in debates or engage him in the primaries at all, that Humphrey may very well have lost the nomination during the convention. Although it doesn't always, in those circumstances, go to the giant killer. I don't know who the third party waiting in the wings would have been. I don't believe that there necessarily was one. But if Robert Kennedy were accused of having torn the party apart, it would have been very difficult to see him actually getting the nomination.
Tom, what do you think?
Oh, I understand what you're saying, and that may well have been. We were so emotionally involved, and I dropped out of politics until McGovern. I just walked away from everything because it was odd that night when I was walking into the hotel and the people were walking out stunned, so I hadn't actually physically got in there yet when he was shot. I had two thoughts. One was, oh, my God, not again. And two, I understood how the people of Dallas had to feel. This was my own home. This is where I was born and raised. And this kind of thing did not happen in America, and it didn't happen more than once in America. And I think that was a endemic kind of engram that has gotten to all of us of that particular age that matured, grew up, were idealistic in the 60s. I will leave you with one last what if. I would love to know what it is that Lyndon Johnson said to Arthur Goldberg in quiet in the Oval Office that made that marvelous labor law attorney step down from the Supreme Court.
Well, I wish that I were in on that secret too. There's been a lot said about it. But others have told me that he simply appealed to Goldberg's patriotism, he appealed to Goldberg's ego and convinced him that by stepping down from the Supreme Court and taking the job as a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., that he, Goldberg, could solve the problem in Vietnam, which, of course, didn't quite turn out that way.
Tom's question and the scenario you played out about the rest of 1968 absent the killing at the Ambassador Hotel brings up the other interesting question: what the nominal party leader and sitting president of the United States would have done if things got to Chicago either deadlocked or close. He had already taken himself out, but Hubert Humphrey was his man. What does Johnson do then?
Well, Johnson was actually very ambivalent about Hubert Humphrey's candidacy and didn't do a whole lot to support him. In the book, I describe some of Johnson's attempts to help Humphrey. They were always a bit half-hearted. He allowed his staff sort of underground to help Humphrey by writing speeches and giving him help on the issues and so forth. But Johnson was very unresolved about Humphrey, and there was much bitterness then and much later among Humphrey's supporters or among Humphrey's staff for Johnson's lack of support, and some, including Joseph Califano, one of Johnson's top aides, have indicated that Johnson may have actually preferred Nelson Rockefeller to all other candidates in 1968.
Jeff Schessel is with me in Washington. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Miami, Florida is next. Neil, welcome.
Thank you, Ray. I wanted to go back to a couple of Mr. Schessel's comments he made at the beginning of the show. One regarding John F. Kennedy and ill-tempered comments he might have made against, or may not made against Johnson. And it's my recollection, and certainly can be tested, but that during the nomination, the Democratic Convention, when Kennedy was originally nominated, there were a lot of bad feelings and bad words between the two, and putting Johnson on the ticket as the number two man was a devil's bargain. And it may be that after the nomination, Kennedy was a lot more practical a politician than Robert Kennedy. I don't doubt that they got along well, and Kennedy kept his cool about that. But I seem to recall that there was quite a bit of animosity before that nomination. And the other thing is, regarding the Johnson's relationship with Jackie Kennedy, again, my recollection is that at the time Kennedy was assassinated, the Kennedy people were practically apoplectic that Johnson had the nerve to fly back to Washington on Air Force One. And I don't recall specifically, but in my memory, there was some either actual or perceived slight of Jackie Kennedy at that time. And I was wondering if Mr. Schessel had any information on those two points.
Well, I do discuss them actually at length in Mutual Contempt. There were many perceived slights toward Jackie Kennedy during that flight, and particularly before the flight when the plane sat on Love Field in Dallas and waited for a judge to come to the plane to give Johnson the oath of office. He had called Robert Kennedy and asked him, "Do I need to be sworn in as president?" Robert Kennedy was absolutely numb with grief at that moment and wasn't quite sure what advice to give to Lyndon Johnson, but he numbly agreed that that Johnson could go ahead and take the oath of office there. In fact, Johnson was already automatically president upon the death of John Kennedy, so it didn't need to be done. But Johnson didn't want to be accused of taking any missteps, of hungrily grabbing power. He wanted everything to be done by the book. So the plane waited on the ground, and it waited for a very long time, and it was very hot inside, and people were absolutely miserable and stricken with grief as Jackie Kennedy sat in the back with the president's coffin, with John Kennedy's coffin. And there was much bitterness among the Kennedy aides on that flight, and as soon as they got back to Washington, they reported many imagined incidents to Robert Kennedy. Others on the flight don't remember any of these incidents taking place, and certainly Johnson's treatment of the Kennedy family in the hours and the days after the assassination indicate that he acted at no time with anything but complete sensitivity and dignity towards the family. So that was at issue between Johnson and Robert Kennedy, but it was probably unfair, although understandable on Robert Kennedy's part, knowing what he was feeling.
Neil in Miami, Florida. I think we have time for one more. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Edward, welcome.
Hi. I'd like to recall an incident that happened the night before President Kennedy was assassinated. I was living in the Washington area, and I was entertaining a foreign diplomat who was based in Washington. Obviously, neither one of us knew there was going to be an assassination the next morning. He remarked, and I quote, "Your president, Kennedy, and particularly his brother, are very conservative, and they're pretending to be liberals. And they get away with it because they came from the Northeast. While your Vice President Johnson is quite liberal, but his liberalism is suspect and not recognized by Democratic liberals because they believe that all Southerners are conservatives." And he kept particularly making the point that Bobby was not a liberal at all. And I wonder whether your guest would like to comment on the validity of this particular point of view by a very astute foreign diplomat.
Well, I think that was a very astute judgment with respect to Lyndon Johnson. I'm not quite sure how he perceived that in Johnson, because there was very little to go on at that point. He was right, but it's difficult to see where he saw that. With respect to Robert Kennedy, I don't think that he was pretending to be liberal, although his actions as Attorney General during the civil rights crises of the Kennedy administration led many to believe that he was actually a closet conservative. In fact, he was really at heart a Federalist, and he had great difficulty with the idea of the federal government intervening down south and setting a precedent that might be dangerous in the future. Some saw this maybe fairly as a cop-out, but what emerged over the course of the next 5 years after John Kennedy's assassination, I think, was a very genuine evolution on Robert Kennedy's part, and some very close to him argue that he was only really able to express himself politically in those years when he was freed from being his brother's political watchdog.
And from being the Attorney General of the United States. You saw a different person as the junior senator from New York than you did in federal office and constrained by the needs of the office. But certainly, I guess if you plot his evolution from being a co-counsel to the McCarthy Committee to the days just before his death, there is some movement.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And Robert Kennedy was full of all sorts of interesting contradictions. He could be an anti-communist at the same time as a progressive liberal on social issues at home, at least over the course of the decade. He did not stop being an anti-communist over the course of that decade, but he did question the morality of U.S. Intervention in Vietnam, question the validity of the domino theory. He definitely evolved on many levels as a public figure during those years.
Edward in Portland, Oregon, thanks a lot for your call, and thanks to everyone who called this hour. Jeff Schessel, good to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Ray.
Jeff Schessel is the author of Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. He's also the creator of Thatch, a nationally syndicated political comic strip. He joined us in Washington from NPR's Studio 3A. Earlier, we talked to Arthur Schlesinger Jr., special assistant to President John F. Kennedy and biographer of Robert Kennedy. He joined us by phone from his New York City office.